I'm here at the Melbourne Writers Festival today, and I've been lucky enough to catch up with Patrick Gale, who just come out of a session, talking mostly about his most recent book, A Perfectly Good Man, which I think was his 14th novel, but also about an earlier novel, Notes from an Exhibition. Thanks, Patrick, for making the time to speak to us this morning.
Pleasure, John.
Now, your Twitter profile says you're a gardener, a cellist, a cook, a whippet walker, and when time allows, a novelist. Now, it sounds like you're sort of selling yourself a bit down a little bit, because having read recently read A Perfectly Good Man, I'm particularly interested in the structure of the novel and that sort of shifting of time and character and focus, which is a little bit like Notes from an Exhibition as well. But scattered sort of fragments of the story, I suppose, it seemed to me sort of the sort of organic way that we get to know anybody. We don't get to know them in a straight line, but
exactly.
All those sort of fragmented stuff. A couple of questions, I suppose. Why did you use this structure for this particular story?
Well, it was conceived as a companion volume to Notes from an Exhibition. Not a sequel, but linked. And I wanted to reflect that by using the same structure, but
yes.
It was also, I realised very quickly, a structure that would work equally well for this story, because I like to begin my books with an unanswered question, and the unanswered question in this case is what makes a perfectly good man
yes.
become a priest, because
yes.
it's such a horrible job.
Yes.
Why on earth would you want to do that? And you don't work out, I myself didn't know what the answer was until I wrote the very, very last chapter in the book when Barnaby is a child. So I needed
yes.
to go back in time to
yes.
find that.
Yes.
But I like, I'm glad you picked up on this point of the it being a bit like real life, in that when you make a new friend or you meet somebody who might become a friend, they only give you a careful version
right.
of themselves to
yes.
start with, and gradually
yes.
they reveal the other layers. And
or other people reveal them to you
yeah.
as well. Yeah.
And so with Barnaby, as with Rachel in Notes and Exhibition, you get to know her gradually. The character takes you into her confidence. And I hope that means that by the end of the book you feel as if you actually, it's created the illusion of a real person.
Yes, yes. Does it matter to you that it can be a bit confusing at sometimes? I was a bit confused in the beginning.
I don't mind. I think one of the beauties of fiction, one of the beauties of the printed page, is
yes.
that you can reread.
Yes.
So if you get muddled, you can think, hang on, and
yeah.
go back.
Mm.
And it's a risk. It's always a risk that you will lose your reader and they'll just say, sod this, and they'll
yes.
stop reading.
Yes.
But I find an awful lot of my readers say what they do is they read the book once fast and then they read it again almost immediately, slowly.
Yes.
And they
yes.
get a lot more out of it the second time around, because I think because of the way I write my books, not in the order in which they appear. I write them one character at a time.
Yes, you're saying that this
It
morning.
Means that they're full of little bits of information whose significance isn't clear the first time you read it. But if you go back,
yes.
you realise, actually that's
yes.
much, that
yes.
is significant. So,
yeah. I suppose that links to the second part of my question, which is, and you'd said a little bit about this morning, how you achieve such a structure, because to me it's such an intricate sort of structure, and I don't know how I could sort of possibly work it out in my head.
It does involve holding an awful lot of balls in the air at the same time.
Yes.
I make a lot of use of post-it notes. I saw a wonderful photograph the other day of Will Self's, the author Will Self, of his study, and one wall was just a mass of post-it notes.
Yes.
So I was glad to see I'm not the only one who uses them. But actually, for me, initially it's not that complicated, because I'm simply doing one character at a time, their story, nobody else's story. So I induce a kind of tunnel vision for myself.
Yes.
Where it gets complicated is when I come to weave the stories together.
Yes.
And at that point, although I'm normally a pen and ink writer, I don't like working on the computer. I do use the computer structurally at that point.
Yeah.
I try to do a plan of what appears to be the story and get an overview of the shape and work out then what's the best point at which to drop in certain bits of information.
And a well-earned coffee has just arrived as we speak.
Gasping for coffee.
Indeed. Well, perhaps I'll ask a longer question, give you a chance to sort of have a little bit of a sip of your coffee. Now, Father Barnaby is, it seems like you've sort of chosen him as a little bit of the epitome of supposed goodness. You know, he's a priest. Now, I'm a former Catholic priest myself, so I'm really interested in that.
Congratulations,
sort of,
you escaped.
I did. It took me a while, but I saw the light eventually. But do you choose that sort of role as, I suppose, as usually an epitome of goodness or someone who's held up this?
Well, funnily enough, I chose the role initially as the epitome of fatherhood. It was fatherhood I was really interested in writing about rather than goodness. And the goodness was a sort of an extra element that came in because he was a priest. And what interested me initially was the idea of a priest as a family man, and obviously not a thing that Catholic priests experience.
No.
And the conflicts of wanting to be a good father to your own children, and yet having to act as a sort of surrogate father to a whole community of people.
Yes.
And the irony that, you know, in Cornwall, rather like in a lot of Catholic communities, the priest, even though it's Anglican, priest tends to be called father by everybody.
That's right.
Even if they don't know him.
Yes.
And it's this constant reminder that you are the father to all these people.
Yes, he wants to be a good man, doesn't he? But and you sort of said a little bit earlier, too, about this, what you're exploring is sort of in the novel, goodness as well as sort of badness.
And the impulses behind it. I mean, there's a scene, very painful little scene, very near the end of the book, when Barnaby is a child, and his adored gay uncle says to him, "Please don't feel you always have to be good. You know, sometimes you're so good, it's almost painful to watch."
Right. Yes.
And that was slightly autobiographical, and I was a painfully good child. I think there's a lot of. I was the youngest child in a big family, and I think it's often the case that the youngest child feels that they have to be good because their parents are so obviously exhausted all the time, that's never left that sort of hideous sense of duty and need to be good, the need to be no trouble.
So
to some extent, I was turning. I'm by no means a good person, but no. I was turning the mirror on myself.
And you do use, I mean, the Quakers and the Church of England are sort of, I suppose, traditionally two supposed sort of religious traditions that have given sort of guidance to people in goodness over the years. But you seem to sort of be saying that they're not too reliable, even for your characters. So
they're not too reliable, but they are. But both the Quakers and the Church of England can be a source of great strength as well. And what I'm like to explore, I think I've done in these two books, is to show the ways in which you can selectively benefit from these organizations. You know, I think a strong person who enters the Quakers becomes a very strong person. I think a bad person who enters the Church of England can become an even worse person. I think it depends on the raw material you're working with.
So is that about motive?
Do you want to pause while these children pass us, or is this okay?
Yeah, maybe.
Is it local colour?
A little bit of local colour, yeah. Let's just trust the recorder.
We'll keep going.
That's okay. A little bit of background. Now, you have great compassion for your characters, though. Tremendous compassion, you know, for their badness, for their failings and mistakes, but also for their goodness. And today's session was a little bit about sort of the complexity of goodness and badness. For your characters, it seems like sometimes, you know, there's the inability to do the things that they know they should do. Is that the sort of thing that you're exploring?
Yes, I mean, what I always think of as the tyranny of the oughts, where we're bound with oughts, especially if we have... Depends on your childhood, I suppose. I had an extremely moral childhood, full of very strong moral examples and lessons, and it hasn't left me. I find to this day I'm forever doing things I don't want to do because I feel I ought to do them.
Yes.
And for a novelist, that's a gift because because I think so many plots emerge from the conflict between what you want to do and what you feel you ought to do. And my last novel, The Whole Day Through, which is it's a novel about, there's no hiding it, it's a novel about adultery, which is not a good thing. And yet, the challenge to myself was to explore it in a way that would make the adulterers sympathetic and understandable, even though what they were doing was probably wrong, judged in black and white terms, and to show that actually there are shades of grey in all these questions, that you could be a good adulterer.
It's bigger than sort of just perhaps obeying certain rules, or the whole idea of morality is much wider, isn't it?
And you know, the whole... I haven't yet really written a straightforward love story, but love and sex and those impulses are they're fascinating to a writer, because they're the thing that you can't always control, yes, and they're yes. the thing that will sometimes tempt you to do the wrong thing or to damage somebody in the name of doing the right thing.
But, So it's really exploring what human beings are about, I suppose, isn't it?
I think so. I mean, for me, this is the beauty of the novel as yes. a form. It's this wonderful arena in which you can,
yes.
without being too heavy-handed about it, you can investigate quite dark, deep questions while using the mechanism of a comedy.
Now, I haven't read all your books. I've read Notes from an Exhibition, Gentleman's Relish, your latest book, and also The Whole Day Through. And it sort of occurred to me that a number of gay characters, but they're sort of on the edge. But then I sort of did read somewhere that one of your earlier books, Rough Music has quite a prominent gay character.
Absolutely.
And I wondered where, and this question was sort of hinted at a bit earlier in the session, was where do you sort of stand in that area of sort of needing to present gay characters in a certain way? I don't mean...
I know what you mean. I mean, it's the eternal problem for gay writers that
I mean,
because there are so few gay characters in fiction, relatively few, you are under pressure slightly to make them nice people good people.
Certainly,
but that's incredibly boring.
Anyway.
That's incredibly boring.
Yes.
So I think the trick is to make them sympathetic people who are flawed.
Mm.
So Rough Music is a very good example, because the hero and the heroine of Rough Music are a son and a mother.
Yes.
Each have an affair with their brother-in-law.
Yes.
So they both behave badly, very badly, and there is terrible fallout from what they do.
Mm.
And yet they're both presented as sympathetic characters. So
yes.
I hope they're people that the reader comes to forgive and understand.
Yes. Well, I like that sort of, that you're concentrating on the gay characters being there, but sort of not having the spotlight on them. I know, I was reading this morning, there's a local television program coming up about stay-at-home fathers, and one of them happens to be a gay father. But
oh, good.
The program says there's no special significance given to that.
It's
there.
Part of the texture. That's how it should be.
And
I think certainly gay writing and lesbian writing is... come of age, it's been around long enough now in the mainstream that you don't feel, well, I certainly as a gay writer, I don't feel I have to make every book about being gay, because
that's not the real world, right?
Well, and also it's not terribly interesting for me anymore.
No.
I feel I've done that.
Yes.
Though my next novel is going to be very gay, in the central character will be gay, but it's as much about love and hypocrisy as that. And it's historical, so it'll be set in about 1910, when it was very dangerous and difficult to be gay. So it's as much about the difficulty as the gayness, I think.
Yes, yes.
But what interests me in that particular case is going to be writing about that subject using a setting, a time setting, in which there wasn't the vocabulary to describe what you were feeling.
No.
So the word gay was not in use. This person won't have... he won't have the vocabulary to describe what he wants. And that, I think, for a novelist is a challenge.
Yes.
And I can't wait to get my teeth into it to see where it takes me.
We'll be looking forward to reading it too.
Mm.
Just finishing up, actually, my last question is, you're a gardener, I understand.
Very obsessive gardener.
Well, I'm an obsessive gardener too, and I was wondering how the writing and gardening sort of fit in. Does one sort of fit into the other? Or
they work beautifully. I have a what I call the Richard and Judy shed, because the Notes and Exhibition was featured on the Richard and Judy show, which brought me a huge readership. I was very grateful. And with part of the money I raised from that, I was able to build this lovely office in the garden.
Yes.
So my desk looks straight out into an unweeded flower bed. So I am forever nipping out from the desk to deadhead things and pull up weeds and whatever.
Well, does that sort of apply to your writing too? Are you doing a lot of deadheading and pulling up weeds, or
kind of, yes. And I think
similar process.
But I find I do a lot of my writing carries on in my head while I'm doing other things.
Mm.
And gardening, a bit like walking, is a very good activity for writers, I think, because you often do a lot of your editing while you're away from the book, physically away from the book.
Yes.
It's carrying on in your head.
Indeed.
So repetitive. I love weeding, because it's a as much as I love reading, it's mostly repetitive tasks.
Weeks, I'm you weeding my garden.
Oh, I would happily come and weed your garden. I'm very keen to go back to the Botanic Gardens here in Melbourne.
Yes, because beautiful.
I vividly remember them last time I was here, and
yes,
I always have to resist the urge to fill my pockets with seed heads. My garden at home is full of Australian plants.
I've
smuggled into England.
Your Moreton Bay fig that I think was illegally taken back to...
and sadly it died. It died because it's very sad, so I need to get another one, I think.
You do. We'll have to send you one.
Yeah. But I'm very, very proud. I've got a lovely Norfolk Island pine that grows in my kitchen. In a big pot in the kitchen.
That's really
big. My husband was a bit alarmed when he looked it up in the book and saw that it could grow to 200
it's
feet.
Very big, yes.
I don't think that'll happen in my lifetime.
You better plan it out very quickly.
I need a bigger pot, I think.
Patrick, it's been a pleasure talking to you.
It's been a delight,
thank
John.
You very much.
Thank you so much.
Well, I think we'll give up and give in to the background noise. And thank you again for talking to us today.
Thank you.